You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back. Lots. A brand new week. A shiny new week. A snowy new week if you live where I live, which is Seattle, Washington, where it was snowing today. Big old huge flakes. It was really quite glorious. And so for the morning, we had lovely, you know, the dark evergreen trees all covered with snow, plus the lacy deciduous trees where each individual twig is picked out. With a little tiny layer of snow. It was really quite glorious this morning. But of course, now it's just back to being Battleship Gray. And we're here on this fine Monday with Sherry Antonetti, who is trying to get a word in edgewise while I just talk and talk.
Lots of luck. Okay. Well, I was just going to say that here, the rule of the White Witch has been broken and spring has sprung.
Okay. Well, we had a little bit of that last week. It was quite pleasant, and the crocuses are out, and we started to get some daffodils, but then they got stomped by some.
Yeah, we have forsythia blooming and even some cherry blossoms. So
really, cherry blossoms already?
Yes, yes.
Wow, that's pretty early. Okay, well, that's better than us. Yeah, we're still, it's just like Battleship Gray out there, and the snow has melted mostly, and it's just back to being, you know, bleak.
But, I'm so sorry.
Well, you know, those things happen. But although it is bleak outside, there is sunshine in our hearts.
That's right.
Tomorrow is Mardi Gras. We had our big, what's French for Saturday? You know?
Sister Emily would kill me that I do not know, but I do not know. Okay.
No, that's all right. Someone out there, if you know, give us a call and tell us what. Because we had Mardi Gras on Saturday, so it was Saturday Gras.
Saturday Gras. Well, what did you have for eat on Saturday for Mardi Gras? Oh,
gumbo, woman.
What kind of gumbo?
Good shrimp gumbo.
Okay.
Yes, it was super great.
I'm jealous.
Yes, we had the big parish thing. So the Knights of Columbus, to which I belong.
Okay.
They do this big Mardi Gras thing. And so we, you know, we decorated the parish hall and we set up had all the gigantic big old bowls of gumbo sauce and a ton of rice. And it was super duper good.
I got to tell you, I grew up eating gumbo in the summers and just totally, I'm very jealous. Samedi is Saturday, apparently. I just got a little note.
Samedi. Okay. That sounds.
Samedi Gras.
Samedi Gras. That sounds suspicious.
It sounds good. Yeah.
It sounds like an Iraqi name. It doesn't sound like French to me. But, you know, who am I? The wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not touch it. The country's done for. So I guess it's Samedi. Yeah. But at any rate, it's probably not because I'm bad at French. I took French in high school, but I was.
So did I.
It's just not a useful language to know if you're living in Washington in the mid-1970s, you know?
Well, it would have come in handy if I could have remembered it when my husband and I were on our honeymoon and we were in, we were going to Montreal and he asked me to read the signs and I couldn't do it.
Well, actually, it wouldn't help you much in Montreal either because what they teach in American schools is Parisian French. Which is not the same as Quebecois. Speak as someone with an uncle who was from Quebec, and that French is just really different French. But at any rate, we're here and it's all happening. Tomorrow is true Mardi Gras, when people go out and do all those things that you do on Mardi Gras in preparation for
Lent.
And then Lent begins on Ash Wednesday. You know, Ash Wednesday, it's fascinating. I think it says something very significant about Catholic psychology that Ash Wednesday is not a holy day of obligation, but Catholics turn out for it in droves. They love Ash Wednesday.
We like our props. Your Palm Sunday, we're all there. And all Ash there Wednesday, we're all there.
It's really funny. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are lots and lots of there are days that are holy days of obligation that Catholics are like, oh, is that a holy day?
Well, that's what I'm saying. They need to give out props and then people would show up. You know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's true. You don't get anything for the Feast of the Assumption, for example, or, you know, for that. But Catholics love Ash Wednesday. And I think that there's something deep in human psychology that, especially in our death-denying culture, really likes the reminder that you're going to die.
It's kind of that, you know, dark humor that we all favor.
Well, I mean, that's Ash Wednesday, right? I mean, yes. You know, remember.
I want to go to Ash Wednesday Mass early in the day. Because I want to have the ashes on my head all day long. You know?
My ashes never last because I have greasy, oily skin and it just wipes off and then it's all gone. But so people just kind of, you know, by later in the day, most people
think you
just
don't bathe.
Well, it's like no trace of a cross left. It's just like you got some dirt on your face, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll take care of it later, you know. And yeah. It's usually nice people, you know, trying to help me out. But there is something about Ash Wednesday that people... I remember hearing Garrison Keillor one time talking about... He was at a funeral of somebody that he knew. And when the funeral was over, whoever was officiating at the funeral offered a prayer for the next person in this room to die. And he said the people that he was with were all like super offended. And he thought to himself, that's a fantastic prayer.
It
you
is.
Know, because, well, he, you know, he's from Lake Wobegon where you know, people are philosophical about these things, you know.
Yes.
And but that's it. What Ash Wednesday is a reminder of is you are going to die. There's not even any question about it. And so stop kidding yourself that something else awaits you.
Well, I love Ash Wednesday, I have to say. I mean, it sounds really weird to say, but I truly, I absolutely love Lent. I know some people don't like Lent. I love Lent because I know for a fact that I don't have enough will, discipline, or self-denying desire in me to avoid or give up or surrender anything without a direct reminder. So
yeah.
I need this. You know, I was like, oh, yeah, I need to do that.
Yeah.
And honestly, some of the most fruitful experiences of my life spiritually have come as a result of Lent. I'll give you a brief, quick story, and that is that in college, I thought I need to do more. You know, I was making good grades. I had a boyfriend. You know, life's good. I need more. Mm-hmm. And Lent was coming up. And so I was like, well, you know, I'll give up Diet Coke or I'll give up chocolate. But I knew that wasn't right. And the people sitting at the table next to me were laughing so hysterically, I thought they were drunk. And it was a Saturday afternoon lunch, so it's possible they'd had a party the night before. I mean, they were falling down out of the chair.
Okay.
And I look over and they all have name tags. So I asked them what they're doing. And they'd come from doing recreational program with the handicapped.
Okay.
And I thought, I'll do that on Saturdays. And I started doing it and I had so much fun. I wound up going and getting a master's in special education. So it became part of my vocation.
Oh, really?
As a result of Lent.
Well, that's pretty cool.
It was pretty cool. It was really a mind blowing kind of experience. I never would have thought that would have been something I would have found.
Uh-huh.
But for the Holy Spirit saying, hey, look over here. These people are having fun. Come over here.
Well, that's okay. That's cool.
You know, and the other one is my dad's dying on Ash Wednesday.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
He died on March 5th of 2014. And it was a beautiful death. It really, truly was.
Okay.
And that Friday we had the rosary and the wake, and my dad's brother looked at him laid out in his Sunday best, and my father had always struggled with weight and eating, and my uncle said, "The things my brother does to get out of fasting." And we fell down. Just wiping tears.
Good.
So, Lent is a very sacred, special time to me for many reasons. There you go.
Your dad died just a month before my mom did.
Yeah.
That was a really weird
time.
Period. Well, it was strange. My mom died. So, my mom had... It was diagnosed with cancer, and they gave her about a month or so. And on April 8th of 2014, our granddaughter, Seraphim, was born.
Oh.
And then 5 days later, it was like this weirdly orchestrated providential thing. So we had to go. Well, I have to finish the story after the break. We had to go down, and I have two brothers, and the big mission on the April 12th was to basically move all this stuff out of my mom's apartment. And it was like the one day where we could all be together.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down. Well, I'll tell you the rest of the story when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti. And we're going to be talking about all kinds of interesting stuff, including the Orans position and
aliens.
And aliens and all those other things. And we'll be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Mark Shea. And as the dulcet strains of Ludwig von Beethoven tell us, we are back on the air. It's Monday, and so we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. I was telling a little story about my mom. So 2014, our granddaughter, Seraphim, was born and on the 8th of April. And so this was my mom's great-granddaughter. Second great-granddaughter. And we went down and visited my mom. So she was staying in this, basically this care facility down in Olympia, which is about 70 miles south of where we live. So it was a bit of a haul. But, you know, the doctors are saying it's not going to be long. So, you know, if you want to come and see your mom, now's the time. So we went down, visited her a couple of times, and she was really, she's quite lucid, you know, during the week. Sometimes a little gaga. We went down with my oldest son, Luke, who, to be fair, he does bear a strong resemblance to me.
Okay.
And also, to be fair, I have, for whatever reason, presumably my mom's genes.
Okay.
I haven't aged as much as other people the same age as me.
Okay.
Just to give you some background, my mom, when she was in her late 70s, started coloring her hair to look lighter.
Okay.
Because she was afraid that people would think that she colored her hair because she never went gray, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. So it was like this, Okay, so wait, you're coloring your hair so people won't think you're coloring your hair because you want people to think that you went gray even though you didn't actually go gray.
I'm
all right. Good.
Okay.
So that seems to, I seem to have inherited her chromosomes. I've got a little patch of gray in my beard, but mostly I don't look as old as I am. So one time I was swimming with my son. This is just, Luke. Luke's 30 years old.
Okay.
And we were out swimming in Lake Washington. We go out, have a big family party down at the south end of Lake Washington, in usually in July when it's pretty hot here. And so we went out, we swam out to the big dock, the diving dock, and there was a guy out on the dock. And this guy looks at us as we're swimming out there, and he says, "Are you guys brothers?"
And you pumped a fist. I know it. And your son went, "Ugh."
God bless you, sir.
You are my new best friend. Yes.
I said that. I pointed to Luke and said, "No, actually, he's my dad." Oh, really good. So anyway, we went down to visit my mom, and Friday, the 11th of April. And at one point she kind of came to, and she looked at Luke and said, "You know, you have a nice face, Mark." And Luke was just like, "Well, you know," he was, "thank you." You know, and it was very sweet. And then she kind of went back to sleep, you know. So the next day, this was the one day where all the brothers, me and Rick and Mike, could all have time free. And we went out and got a U-Haul and just emptied out mom's apartment that she'd been living in.
Okay.
And to put that stuff into storage. And so it's very seldom that all three of us are together at the same time, because both my brothers are in Olympia and I'm way up here. And so we went home after we'd finished the big move. Went back to Rick's house, and we're just kind of sitting around at Rick's house, and we're all wiped out because we've been moving furniture and stuff for the day. And just as we're kind of sitting down and having our iced tea and relaxing for the first time, the care facility calls and says, "You better get over here. We don't think your mom is going to last much longer."
Oh.
And so we said, okay. So we went over there. And so just, you know, by providence,
yes,
all of us were together. Our wives were with us. And and a number of our children were able to be with us, too.
That's so wonderful.
And so by the time we got there, you know, mom was in a coma. But we sat around the bed for a good long while, you know, and we prayed the Our Father with her, over her.
Yes.
And then eventually my brothers, you know, had to go. We were there for several hours. And so, so I was able to say thank you and, you know, and wish her goodbye, and went home that night. And the next morning was Palm Sunday. And I did not know this until Palm Sunday was the day I found this out. So I went online, and my niece, who lives out in Appomattox, Virginia, had put a note up on Facebook saying that her dad had called her and said that grandma had just died. So it was early in the morning. So Rick hadn't wanted to call us because it was too early out here on the West Coast, but Jen lives out in Virginia, and so it was okay to call her. So he'd gotten the call, you know, like 5 o'clock in the morning from the care facility saying that she had just passed. And so it turns out my mom's name was Phyllis. And I never knew this, but Phyllis is Greek for foliage. And she died on Palm Sunday.
I love it.
Yeah. And so that was kind of weirdly consoling to me, you know?
Well, no, those sort of things are all over, sprinkled all over the place. When you get I mean, you find it, you're like, oh my gosh, that's wonderful. Like my mother got to be with my father when he died. And that was something she had been, my father died of Alzheimer's and after several years, and my mother had cared for him for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
And it had gotten to be too much. And so he was in a home where he could get the care he needed. But, you know, she went to go see him faithfully almost every day. Unless she was out of town, she was there. And I remember praying that she would get to be with him when he died, because my, you know, my family lives down in Texas, and I'm up here in D.C., and my brother's in Baltimore, and my other brother and sister are in Pearland. So really, I just hoped she would be with him. That's what I wanted for her.
Yeah, yeah.
And that 3 days after that prayer, and of course, I was like, I didn't mean now.
Yeah.
You know, that was my reaction. But she was with him. She knew it was happening. She said he took three breaths in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And so it was really, it was a very peaceful death. And, you know, my brothers and sister, we all came in, and it was a, you know, a beautiful funeral. It was a beautiful mass, and it was a beautiful goodbye to someone we loved very much. So I love Ash Wednesday for the very same reason, because it's a reminder that this is not the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the most consoling things I ever ran across is from Cardinal Newman, who seems to have had a real gift for consolation for other people. I know a number of people who have had various encounters with things that he wrote. Sherry Waddell was hugely consoled by something that she ran across when she was about at the lowest point in her whole life. And it was one of the things that helped her toward being a Catholic, actually. One of the things that's always helped me was somewhere or other, Newman remarks that, all who have ever lived, live still.
Yes. And that's beautiful. It's true.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true.
Yeah. So, and I have, in a way that I never had with anybody else who was close to me, I've had a number of, how should I put it? Consoling encounters with grace obtained through, I think, through my mom's prayers. I pray for my mom all the time, and I ask her to pray for me. And she's come through on a number of occasions that were like,
you've got a connection.
You know, So I don't understand that side of life very well, but it's one of those things where the church says, yeah, sure, you know, you should cultivate that relationship, you know, don't let those relationships drop just because somebody happens to be dead. And so I'm grateful to my mom for that. You know, speaking of prayer, I wanted to bring up something here.
Yes.
Because this dumb stuff comes up, and people get all worked up about it. And it just seems to me to be the sort of thing that there are people who just want somebody that they can do things to.
Oh, dear.
And a lot of this tends to center around liturgy stuff. There are people who obsess over fine points of liturgy because I think that they have things in their life they can't control. So they focus on this, and then they try to control other people through it. And I want to talk about this when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we'll be back right after this.
Sounds good.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
today with Sherry Antonetti. And I want to just talk about something briefly during this segment, because I'm sure that you run across this stuff. It's one of those things that I think all Catholics in America run across at some point or another. And depending on whether or not you're scrupulous, or if you're like me and cannot for the life of you get any interest going at all about this in your heart and soul, I get emails from people who worry about these kinds of things. So there's some website. I've never heard of it before. It's called Catholic365.com. And it's got this big headline, and you run across this on other websites that are often devoted to traditionalist concerns and these kinds of things. So the headline is, "The faithful are not, capital N, capital O, capital T, to use the Orans posture during the Our Father." Well, when it's as authoritative as that headline, people read that and think, oh, yikes, this must be a real thing. And I guess I should be upset about this, or worried about this, or afraid that I have sinned in some way, or that I should be keeping a sharp eye on everybody around me in the pews during Mass to make sure that they're not using the Orans. The Orans position is when you raise your hands while you're praying. That's the Orans.
Right. So, and, you know, yeah.
So you'll typically see a priest. That's how the priest prays, is with his hands in the Orans position. So this is like this authoritative sounding headline that sounds pretty darn serious.
And dire.
And you have been sinning if you've ever done that. And the people around you are sinning if they do that. And you have to, you know, knock it off and feel guilty and go to confession yourself for doing this.
Prayer shaming.
And you need to keep a close eye on those people around you and then start thinking about what needs to be done about them. Do you report them to the priest? Do you need to stop them during Mass or take them aside after Mass and scold them for doing this awful thing that they're not supposed to do for some reason that you're not clear on? But that headline certainly sounds emphatic.
I have heard of Catholics at 365. They actually invited me to write for them.
Oh, yeah?
I decided not to. Because I didn't have enough. I already had enough places I was working for that I felt I'd be too subdivided. But I kind of looked at it, and people like to sound certain and feel. and all I know is I wouldn't, you know. I don't particularly love holding hands during the Our Father. A lot of my children do, but I'm not going to refuse my child's hand because she puts it in there because she wants to say the Our Father with me. You know, and I kind of look at it as that this seems to me like it's more an issue of style than of actual anything else. And to get worked up over style, I want to say there are plenty of churches where no one's putting their hands up.
Well,
you can find one.
here's the thing. There's not only do you get these emphatic decretals from people with a keyboard somewhere out on the web telling you that, and they link to some source somewhere, but very often the source isn't saying what they think it says or what they really want it to say, but they'll just say, well, this is my understanding, and my understanding is equal to the teaching of the church, and et cetera, et cetera. And really what you're looking at is just somebody has a particular kind of piety that they want to impose on everybody else. And I'm going to give you 16 words out there in Radio Land that will liberate you from ever having to think about or worry about this kind of thing ever again. So if you go to the U.S., Conference of Catholic Bishops, there's actually a thing that talks about posture during the Eucharistic prayer and the Our Father. And the first question that it asks is, should people stand or kneel during the Eucharistic prayer? I'm not going to go into that. Just, whatever the do. You can go to this website yourself and find out what the church has to say about stuff like this. But here's the question that they address that has to do with this whole Iran's position. Some people hold hands during the Lord's Prayer while others hold their hands out, like the priest. Is there a prescribed posture for the Our Father? Here is the 16 words that the USCCB have to tell us that liberate us forever from ever having to worry about what some guy with a keyboard at Catholic365.com says. Quote, no position is prescribed in the Roman Missal for an assembly gesture during the Lord's Prayer. Period. In other words, do whatever you like.
But what does that really mean, Mark?
Yeah. Do whatever you like, and don't worry about what the person next to you is doing, and God be with you. And that's it. That's all there is. There is no prescribed position. And so the church doesn't tell you what to do. So if you're one of those people, like I am, who just customarily prays in the Oran's position because that's how I happen to pray, then knock yourself out. And if you're somebody who doesn't do that, that's fine, too.
You're both being reverent if you're being reverent. And you're both being irreverent if you're being irreverent. And
that's
it's not
right.
Dependent on where your hands are and up or down.
I hold my wife's hand while we're praying the Our Father because I like praying together with my wife. I'm one of those kind of people.
Yes.
Like doing that. And you know, the point, of course, goes back to Romans chapter 14. Paul tells the Romans, in essence, he doesn't use these words, but this is basically how the church's tradition of aphorism and maxim has boiled it down, is in essential things, unity, in doubtful things, liberty, in all things, charity. There you go.
There you go. You fixed it up for
everybody.
We can all we can close up the Catholic internet now. We've done it. All that needs to be said. All that needs That's to right. be said.
I think that, you know, people worry about these for a number of these things for a number of reasons. One is, yes, there is real liturgical abuse.
Yes.
That does happen sometimes. Although, you know, the occasions of liturgical abuse are they're greatly amplified by hypersensitivity about liturgical abuse. My attitude is, you know, if having to sing anthem is like the worst martyrdom I ever endure, well, I've really gotten off a lot better than the Hiroshima martyrs.
Yeah, I was going to say, oh, please, you know, if the worst I have to deal with is felt banners and guitar strings, I'll be okay.
Yeah, I don't mind either of those, really. It's just like, okay,
I don't either,
So people worry about this kind of thing. And yeah, and plus, there are people who are scrupulous who are afraid that they're somehow offending God. And the people who write articles like that one on Catholic 365, a lot of what drives that, frankly, is not so much concern for the glory of God as it is, it's a real feeling of power when you can shame scrupulous people and make them feel guilty.
In the interest of charity, I think a lot of times these articles are written with a great deal of earnestness and zeal, whether or not, and so
true. But you know,
it's misplaced because it's lacking a charity towards those who are scrupulous, who
right.
would be made anxious. And the Mass is not about making you anxious. It's about getting you to rest
right.
in the presence of God.
Exactly. And so, you know, my question is always, where is love in this? And so often it's not about love. It's about this kind of fearful notion that God is a God of crossed T's and dotted I's. Who obsesses with over these small things, you know, and this is a classic example of how I've had people, you know, ask me what isn't the mission of the magisterium to define everything for us so that we don't
go astray.
So we don't go astray. And, you know, really, most times the mission of the magisterium is not to define things. It's to leave things open like this so that we're not spending all of our time worrying about stuff like, is he praying with his hands in the Orwant position? You know,
the mission of the magisterium is to invite us always deeper and deeper in. And that means you're not sitting there looking for ways to keep people out.
Yes.
And that's the way to look at it.
Exactly. And so when you start treating the sacraments or the liturgy like an enormous complex set of reducing valves that's designed to make sure as few people as possible have access to the grace of God.
Or sort of like a magic dance. If you do it the right way, then, you know.
Did he? Oh, that invalidated the entire
jazz hands.
I did that thing with his hands. All right. Well, good. Well, when we return, we're going to talk about whether the Catholic faith will be able to cope if they ever find E.T. And we'll be back with Sherry Antonetti right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back after
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. We've been talked in the last segment. We were talking a little bit about the Orwant's position and the church basically saying, there's no prescribed posture for when you're saying the Our Father, so knock yourself out. And now, taking a complete left turn, I wanted to talk about something else just because it amuses me and interests me, and it comes up now and then. People worry about this. I ran across an essay a couple of years ago by an atheist, and then there just popped up something on Crux, which is basically a Catholic site, that was asking a similar question. So the atheist a couple of years ago was theorizing on what Rome was up to, because a couple of Catholic sources remarked that the discovery of life on other planets posed no particular threat to the Catholic faith. This was a couple of years ago. So I think Brother Guy Consolmagno and a couple of other people just happened to be in the press talking about, you know, what would you do if you bumped into E.T. as a Catholic? And the atheist guy was like super suspicious at this.
We're going to convert him. We're going to convert him, and then you'll be in real trouble.
Well, it was like he was deeply suspicious. The Catholic Church was like launching some preparatory campaign in order to cope with it when science discovers E.T., because then they'll be able to say, oh, yes, we don't have any problem with this. And this was somehow overturning centuries of Catholic dogma that, in fact, says that it's impossible for there to be extraterrestrial life. If you can find that dogma, you're a better man than I am. But anyway, he was sure that this was all part of a campaign, a building.
We have so many Vatican conspiracies. We have a whole industry, cottage industry.
Yes. That's what they do, especially in the Vatican archives. And I have it on good authority from somebody or other somewhere.
I read it on the internet. It must be so.
And anyway, so Crux came out with a piece this weekend, basically saying, you know, can Catholicism cope with extraterrestrial life? My friend John Farrell, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, John's a science guy. He's written a book called The Day Without Yesterday. That's a look at the life of Monsignor Georges Lemaître, the guy who he's a Belgian Jesuit physicist who concocted the Big Bang Theory. And anyway, so he was amused by this article saying, you know, can Catholicism cope with extraterrestrial life? And his response was, do we have a choice? I mean, if they find it, then, you know, yes, we'll just have to cope with it. But my response to that question has always been, we already believe in non-human created intelligences.
Yes, we have angels, we have demons,
yes, exactly.
we have archangels. We know, or as I said to you at the time, is that we can't outdo our creator in imagination.
Yeah.
So if like, we can create, you know, Vulcans and Ferengi and Klingons, and then why can't God?
Why can't God do that? Well, to sort of give you the devil's advocate response,
go ahead.
The question that comes up is, well, you know, okay, fine. We believe in non-human intelligences that are not corporeal. So angels. Angels can appear to us. St. Thomas speculates on how they can do that, but he sort of plays around with this question of how is it that spiritual non-corporeal intelligences can become visible to us and so forth. But when we're talking about extraterrestrial life, typically, what we're talking about is organic life.
Organic corporeal beings who exist in time and space and who are immortal and who have intelligence. And therefore, we have the question, do they have souls?
Right. And other questions relate to that. So, you know, Vulcans, unlike angels, are made of meat.
Yes, exactly.
And that's really the question is, are there things out there that are made of meat or possibly... you know, if we're talking about The Thing from Another World, the great Howard Hawks film that's based on the John W. Campbell story called Who Goes There, we're talking about intelligent life, but it's a plant.
Are we a cosmic quirk, a hiccup in the great primordial soup of stuff that makes up everything? Or are we alone in the universe, or are we not alone in the universe?
And
which one frightens us more?
As it happens, C.S. Lewis did us all a favor about 60 years ago, where he took up this question. He wrote a couple of essays. One was called Religion and Rocketry, and the other one was called Will We Lose God in Outer Space? He said, it is possible that the discovery of extraterrestrial life could pose a challenge to Christianity. But here are all the things that have to happen for that to be so. So, first of all, it has to exist.
Yeah, that would be step one.
Which we don't know.
Yes.
Now, I think that it's quite possible that within my lifetime we will finally have a conclusive answer to the question of whether there's life on other planets. I don't think that it's going to come in the form of radio signals from ET. I think what's going to happen, if we find life on another planet, the way we're going to find it, and we can actually do this now, we have identified about 3,500 what are called exoplanets, planets orbiting other stars.
Yes.
Some of them are large enough that we can actually see light reflected from them. A lot of them, basically, the reason we know that they're there is there's a wobble in the star as it spins.
I love that people can find this out. I find that just
so know that
amazing.
There's something pulling on the star, and so it's got to be a planet. But some of these exoplanets are actually, we can see some of the light coming from them. And if we can see the light coming from them, what we can do is we can do a mass spectrometer analysis, and we can see if some of that light is being reflected by chlorophyll. And if we...
Plants.
If we find chlorophyll...
We find plants.
We've established that there's life on that planet. Now, it could be the world's biggest patch of moss. And that's the thing. Is just because we found something alive somewhere, okay, great. But here's the next thing that has to happen. It has to be sentient. Alien moss and alien oysters can't sin any more than other moss and oysters do. And so, big deal. If we find moss on another rock somewhere, okay, good. You know, the third thing that has to have happened is, in addition to being sentient, that life has to have fallen, because an unfallen race is not in any need of redemption and therefore poses no challenge to the Christian gospel, because the Christian gospel is all about what God did for a race that fell. And so, no fallen race, you've got no challenge to the gospel. Fourth, we have to know, and here's the real, okay, it's really tough to even know that a race is fallen.
Right.
Don't know what the baseline is for that race. Things that humans can't do may be perfectly licit for some other species, some other sentient species. But fourth, we'd have to know that being fallen, that race has been denied the chance of redemption by God. Now, how on earth are you going to ever figure that out?
I don't know. Well, I don't know if you can figure it out on earth, but I'm bummed. But, I mean, I think what it comes down to is, you know, do you believe that, you know, that Christ can redeem us? Well, yes. Okay, then. I could argue that, you know, if you haven't been exposed to Christ and living on another planet, you probably haven't, that you would have invincible ignorance. So God, we got to figure out some other way to do this.
Well, and there's, you know, in addition to the problem of, okay, the race has been fallen, it's been denied the chance of redemption by God. Do we know that that shot at redemption will be forever denied?
This
hypothetically existent, hypothetically rational, hypothetically fallen race. If you had visited the Earth 10,000 years ago, you would not have seen all that many obvious signs that redemption was in the works for us either. But
yeah, right.
No, turns out other things happen. And then we would have to know that redemption via an incarnation, death, and resurrection of God the Son in this fallen alien nature is the only way in which God redeems fallen creatures, and that such a redemption will never be granted such creatures. If we answer all of those questions in the affirmative, then we have a challenge to the Christian gospel. That's a problem.
But I don't think we can answer all of those, number one. And I always add to that is that there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in our philosophy. And I'll just stick with that. I find that incredibly comforting that I don't have to have all the answers in order to believe. And I don't have to answer every question that's asked in order to believe. And I find that very comforting.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is that God, of course, God under carefully controlled laboratory conditions
can do whatever he wants, yes.
It's entirely possible, you know, that God has assumed other natures. Who knows? It's just, we just don't know. And that's one of the things that hopefully we'll get to find out when we get there and discover just how many other sentient creatures are out there. But in the meantime,
that'd be wonderful.
We've got angels, archangels, and all the company of heaven, and that's good enough. We already know we've been visited by alien intelligences. Gabriel was one of them. And who knows? Maybe we'll meet our own guardian angel one of these days. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti. Our producer was Danny Head, and we'll be back tomorrow. See you
then. Happy Mardi Gras, guys.
Happy Mardi Gras. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.